CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And before we get started, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News comes to us from the Board of Directors Network, BDN. And this is the results of a 2011 Board of Directors Network census of women board directors of Georgia public companies. The survey has completed four boards in the state of Georgia from filings that are placed with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, for the most recent filings as of middle of August 2011. The Board of Directors Network is a nonprofit advocacy organization that seeks to increase the number of women on corporate boards and in executive leadership positions. And here are the results of the survey. 56% of Georgia's 136 public companies have one or more women on their board of directors. The first time in the study history that over half of Georgia publicly held companies have women on the board. So that's great news for women in the board seat. Women hold 9.6% of the total board seats in Georgia's public companies, which is an increase from 8.6 the previous year. And there are, in fact, listed in the survey 1,116 total board seats. Women hold 107 of those. 13 Georgia public companies are listed in the Fortune 500 2011 list and all have at least one woman director. 10 have more than one woman director, and in this group, women hold 16.6% of the total director positions, the highest ever on record. Worthy of note, Coca-Cola Enterprises has four women directors, and UPS has three women directors, and those held the most women on those seats. 86% of the Georgia top 50 companies ranked by revenue have women on their boards, the highest ever. And 13% of Georgia public companies have a woman of color on their boards, which is up from 10% in 2010. 19% of Georgia public companies have more than one woman on their board. In the Georgia top 50, which is a specific set of Georgia companies, 36% of companies have multiple women board members, while 77% of the Georgia-based Fortune 500-based companies have more than one woman director. And of the 101 women who hold current board seats in Georgia public companies, of these 101, six women sit on two Georgia boards. Some are also on the boards of non-Georgia-based companies. The last couple of elements of statistics, women hold 9.8% of the executive officer positions listed in the SEC filings. Since 1998, when BDN began counting the executive officers listed in the SEC filings, this has ranged from 7 to 10.5%. 57 companies list women in this executive officer group. And the work that is still to be done, more than half of public companies in Georgia have no women officers listed at all in the SEC filings. The percentage of women held board seats is the highest ever reported, yet is still in single digits after 19 years of reporting this data. Saying it another way, over 90% of the board seats in Georgia are filled with men. Only two companies of Georgia top 50 based on revenue have more than two women on board, and women of color have never held more than 2% of all board seats since 2003 when BDN began reporting this particular statistic. And we are including a board of directors focus on today's show because we have an esteemed guest with us. Richard Friedman is joining us today. Richard is a former executive and officer of public and private telecommunications companies, healthcare and manufacturing companies that have domestic and international operational reach. His deep knowledge of board and corporate governance, financial and operational internal controls, federal, state, and industry compliance, risk management, and human resources have enabled him to successfully serve key stakeholders. Richard currently provides executive consulting services, specializing in assessing corporate internal audit organizations for chief audit executives and audit committees of the boards that they serve. In addition, Richard provides winding down consulting services for private organizations. Richard's background in terms of his career, he formerly served as Vice President, Audit, Compliance and Government and Corporate Secretary at EDCI Holdings, an international public traded company, manufacturing and logistics company. Prior to that, he served as Vice President, Audit and Compliance at MedAssets, a publicly traded healthcare IT company. And previously, he was at AT&T and served in several executive capacities, including internal audit, information systems, and program management. Well, Richard, today we have you as a guest. You serve on the boards of, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, Flips Film Inc., and the Savings American Jobs Foundation, and you are a business mentor to the Georgia Tech ATDC. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you very much, Lorraine. I've been looking forward to coming down and talking with you and your guest.
Well, Richard, let's start at the very, very beginning. Way back when maybe you were selling lemonade on the lemonade stand or you're a paperboy. What was your first job, even if you didn't get paid for it?
Well, my first job, believe it or not, was washing cars in high school on the weekends in summer for a car dealership in Birmingham, Alabama.
Did you get paid for it?
I got the opportunity to drive some pretty neat cars.
And you got a good suntan, huh?
I got a great suntan. And it was a great way to keep cool in the summer.
Well, let's trace your steps from being that car wash expert to being today the expert to support the board of directors of public and privately held companies. How did you get from that very first, albeit summertime, job to here?
Well, I started at my first job really out of college was with AT&T, and we were called programmers in those days. The titles are much better today, but we were software developers, and in the information systems organization. And at that time, information systems departments were actually a group within a finance or accounting organization. For those few companies that actually had information system departments. I was fortunate enough to join and get in with AT&T, and I really spent the most of my professional life and career at AT&T.
And was it Bell South in those days?
It started as AT&T, and actually we were Southern Bell and South Central Bell, and then they went through divestiture, and that's when Bell South and the other regional Bells were established. And, of course, now it's come full circle. So I was with AT&T and then Bell South for 25 years. And during that time, had the great opportunity to meet so many wonderful people, so many wonderful experiences. And I wouldn't take anything for them. They're just invaluable. And the things you learn and opportunities you have, if you take advantage of them, are phenomenal. As I said, I started in the information systems organization. I moved out of there. I was actually at one point looking for a little bit of a change and really thinking a change within the information systems organization. And next thing I knew, they're asking me, how about going into internal audit? And quite honestly, I didn't know what internal audit was. I'm embarrassed to say that today, but I didn't. But I was willing to take a chance. I always enjoyed looking at the you know, whatever the next opportunity is. Went in internal audit, had a great time. We did some groundbreaking things at AT&T and then at Bell Labs, and a lot of opportunity and a lot of intellectually challenging and also fun times. And after about 25 years, it was time to say goodbye, and walked out of there and walked almost into an opportunity that was really came sooner than I was expecting, but it was with a company called Glen Air Technologies. Here it is up in Duluth, just outside of Atlanta. They were a technology company, really a telephone equipment and software manufacturing company.
So still with the software theme.
Still with software and still with telephony. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for someone to head up their audit department, to build an audit department. And they were looking for someone with telephony experience, with IT experience, with audit, of course, audit experience.
And you had all three.
Well, there's a lot to be said for being lucky, being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. So here we are today, and tell us a little bit about your role. You advise boards and directors and officers that serve on those boards.
Yeah, so just to continue a little bit, so then we went from Glen Air to MedAssets and then again to head up their audit and compliance program, and then was invited to return to Glen Air. It was about to do a large acquisition. They wanted some help with the due diligence and the program management of it. I'm not a due diligence expert, and I don't claim to be, but looking at the internal controls of the diligence effort and the organization that was being acquired. So I came back, and I say that as a way to kind of build foundation to your question is, during that time, I had this remarkable opportunity to work so closely with the board and the CEO during this diligence period, and got to know them, and that's when I really got involved in the corporate governance side of the house, and then in what's involved and what compliance and audit committee needs and the kinds of things that can help them. When you work closely with people, and Glen Air, or as it was later renamed, EDCI Holdings, is compared to AT&T, of course, most companies are small, but EDCI or Glen Air was a small to mid-cap size company, but we worked very closely with the board, I got to know, as did the other folks who were working closely with the board, we got to know the guys just really well, several of them, honestly, I've been so fortunate in my career to have been around so many smart people and great mentors, and I've learned so much from all of them. But these guys in particular were just remarkable and really opened up to me and helped me understand what they needed, and they saw the skills that I had and how that would help the various committees on the board.
So that's what you do today.
Well, that's right. So today, I spend most of my time consulting when I'm not with my grandkids, and a lot of the consulting I do is on behalf of the Institute of Internal Auditors, and the Institute of Internal Auditors. I'm a consultant for them, and the primary thing we do is do external quality assessments of internal audit departments for other organizations, for other companies. And also I'm working with EDCI during a wind down phase and doing some consulting for them.
Gotcha. Well, Richard, lately you've been involved in assessing internal audit organizations. You've talked about your assistance mm-hmm. with the IIA. Can you explain why an organization or their board would request an assessment of their internal audit organization? One would think that the internal audit function was the one assessing everybody else.
And that's exactly right. And that's almost the definition or the reason why, because you typically think of the internal audit organization as being the one who's doing the assessing, and then the question comes up, well,
who's overseeing the overseer?
Exactly. Who took the words out of my mouth? So, and that's where we come in, and the who better to do that than the professional standard setting organization for the internal audit profession, which is the Institute of Internal Auditors. So on behalf of them as consultants, we will go in and into different companies and do assessments of their internal audit shops. And we do that for the organizations themselves, management. The chief audit executive will sometimes request it. Sometimes the audit committee, someone on the audit committee will request it. And they do that because they want to know. It's their way of knowing. Well, really two reasons. Their way of knowing how well their audit organization, is it really performing the way it should perform? I mean, you see it on the internally, you see it, but you may not have other, you may not be able to compare it to other companies and what and best practices.
Do you do benchmarking on comparisons?
We absolutely do, and there's really two things that the assessments look at. We look at compliance with the Institute of Internal Audit Standards, and we look at best practices. So we're trying to advise. We will advise companies and the audit committees and internal audit management on their level of compliance with internal audit standards, and if there are some best practices that they could be following that they're not, and we will make those recommendations to them.
How long does an assessment take?
Well, an assessment can take. Generally, they'll take between 1 and 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, but they're typically either 1 or 2 weeks.
So it's not that much of an undue burden on a company.
It's not a burden, and honestly, the people that I've had the opportunity to work with in the various companies have enjoyed the process. They've learned a great deal from it. In fact, just before this program, I got an email from a gentleman at a company that I was at a week ago, and thanking me and telling me how much he appreciated it and how unobtrusive we were and how much they value the recommendations and wanted
to
continue the dialogue.
That's fabulous. Well, what is the scope of the internal audit assessment?
The scope is, there are a number of things we look at, and in my opinion, the two most important are the independence of the internal audit organization and their communications with the audit committee. I'll talk about those two for just a second. Independence of an internal audit organization is fundamental. If they're not clearly independent, then there's a big waste of time, and you're not, if you're the audit committee, there's
a
possibility.
You're not getting the effectiveness.
That's right. You're not getting the quality. You're not getting the effectiveness. Mm. Communication with an audit committee, the head of the audit organization has got to have good relationship. Got to have a good relationship with the chair of the audit committee and the other members. It has to have a very frequent communication path set up, clear and open communications anytime he needs to, and that's part of the independence. Other areas we look at are, we look at the quality of the work paper documentation that the audit staff prepares. We look at timeliness of reviews.
So you're kind of the PCAOB.
That's right, and we don't, obviously we don't model ourselves after a government organization, but
no.
we take on that air in some respects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you've been in so many different audit executive roles. Which of a chief audit executive many roles do you think is the most important, and why? And I ask this question because in many organizations, you may think that different roles needs a different particular emphasis. Tell us a little bit about that.
In my experience, the number one criteria for a successful chief audit executive is to be able to convey information that may be negative and not do it in an adversarial way. You've got to be able to communicate well with people. I mean, that just gets down to fundamental interpersonal communication skills. You've got to be able to have your facts right, but do it and present it in a way that's not threatening, that's not adversarial, not antagonistic, and you have to do it in a way that is perceived as value add, and maybe I should say not perceived, but is in fact value add.
Constructive rather than critique.
Well, that's right, and part of that is how audits get scoped in the first place, and are you looking at important high risk areas or not?
And is part of that involving your corporate executive management to help you determine or to help you determine what the risk of the company business operations is, but also inclusion is one of the best ways to get buy-in.
Absolutely. And the whole risk process, the risk management process, and integrating that into a internal audit department's audit plan is fundamental. That is absolutely key. In most companies, most sizable companies today will have an ERM, an enterprise risk management process. That's got to be structured correctly. It's got to be set up correctly. And most importantly, it's got to have the buy-in of the right people and the participation of the right people. And that just comes from tone at the top. If the ERM process is set up correctly, that is one of the primary drivers of an audit plan. And that's one way that management, the board, and ensures that internal audits are driven in the right direction.
And communication of that is absolutely key, because very often you're delivering an unpleasant message.
That's exactly right. You've got
kind of the watchdog.
Well, that's right. You're looking at internal controls in the company. You're looking at risk. And you've got to be able to tell people that in a way that it's not a personal thing. It's business. And in this case, it truly is. That's kind of a cliche sometimes. But in fact, it is just business. And so often people will take it personal. In fact, they usually do if it's not presented in the right context, if you don't have the right facts to back it up. And again, if it's not perceived as value added.
And again, part of that communication is written, not verbal.
Oh, for sure.
So you've got to be a good communicator in terms of the written word,
the
audit report.
Sure, the dreaded audit report. Well, you know, the best way to affect that is you communicate it verbally. You communicate the results verbally before their results. They're not even, you wouldn't even call them results. These are issues that we see at this point. We're not sure if what the status is. Help us figure this out and bring the management into it and let them explain it. And the best possible outcome is they come to the conclusion themselves that, oh, this is a
problem.
There's a risk here and there's no control that's in place to mitigate that risk, or the control is in place, but it was not designed correctly, or maybe it was designed correctly and there's not compliance to it. So you have to be able to, as you said, you've got to be able to communicate it verbally, but and also in writing. And
yeah, well, let's take that one step a little bit further. How does your role in coming into the organization and being that overseer impact Sarbanes-Oxley and the weaknesses, the materiality discussions that take place, and the internal control structure? Are you considered to be an added control to the process for Sarbanes-Oxley?
No, we are not considered a control for Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley is a, and that's an interesting area all to itself, because today you see a lot of companies where their internal audit departments have responsibility for not only internal audit but Sarbanes-Oxley. And a few years ago, almost virtually all internal audit organizations were responsible for both.
Do you have an opinion on conflict there?
Well, it's not so much an opinion on conflict as it is an efficiency issue, because sometimes there's a couple of ways you can crack the SOX nut, if you will. And one way is you can move the testing of SOX controls, of internal controls for SOX purposes, to another organization within the company. You, assuming those people have the requisite skills, you do that. But then you may lose, you run the risk of losing some of the reliance that your external auditor places on what internal audit does. And that means they can't rely on the work, which means more billable hours from your external auditor. So in that sense, there's an incentive to keep it in internal auditing, because generally the cost for internal auditing to test something is going to be less than the cost for your outside auditor to test mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, sure. So it's a complement.
It is. And typically people who are trained in internal audit have the right skills to do SOX testing, because we've been doing it since Sarbanes-Oxley came on. And
not quite a decade, but it's long enough to be long in the tooth.
Yeah, it seems like 2 decades sometimes.
That's just because there's a lot of overtime involved, right?
Well, it is. And it's, you know, it's interesting thing to me, because you know, so I've got mixed feelings about Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, from a shareholder standpoint and a board standpoint. The value, there is value there, because there are controls that are being tested, or they're being examined to see if they're in place, if they're effective, if they're designed correctly, and all that. And as a shareholder, you want to know those things, but it's not free. There's a cost involved, and you have to balance that. And I think what we're seeing now is, over the years, as companies, and particularly internal audit departments, become more efficient and in the way they do their SOX testing, the cost of testing those controls is dropping.
Yeah, and thank goodness it is, because it was quite high.
It was, no doubt about it. And I remember almost like yesterday when we had the first year of SOX, and we were all scratching our heads saying, you know, what does it mean? And not just,
and the auditors were doing the same. They went to the other end of the spectrum by saying, okay, everything's a material weakness. I mean, almost you had those conversations with auditors, and some of that first battle was between you and your auditor, because it was so new for both parties. They were trying to figure out where their comfort zone, their risk was.
That's right, and they were scratching their heads too, because they hadn't figured it out,
and there hadn't been any lawsuits yet, so they wanted to be on the safe side of green pastures.
Well, that's right, and I'll
let you be with the sharks.
Well, that's right, but at the same time, I'll tell you, I was probably more aligned with some of their thinking than maybe I should have been, because I'm thinking about protecting the company and being very risk averse. You want to make sure, okay, I do want to have all the control. I want to make sure I've got all the controls in place that I need to have. I want to be sure that I'm in compliance with these very new federal regulations. And at the same time, how can I inject those into the company without causing disruption? And will they complement the controls that are already in place and that we may already have planned? So, and one of the things that we always said was, we will know when we have arrived in kind of the SOX world, when people stop looking at controls as either their day-to-day controls on one hand or SOX controls on the other hand.
There
should be the one. When they're institutionalized and they're integrated together, and people just say, these are the controls we have. Certainly not for all companies, but in many companies, that's where we're starting to see.
And I do remember a time, and I won't say the company I was with at the time, but it was a sizable Fortune 100 company. At the time, we would try and get things done. I was in finance, and we would try and ask various other departments, IT or customer service or one of the other operational departments, to help us. And it would be put on the back burner. But there was one very easy, quick thing where it would get to number one on the list. Oh, well, we have to do this for Sarbanes-Oxley. And all of a sudden, you'd get what you needed done. And
that's right.
There was a lot of playing with that at the very beginning. But, I mean, obviously, for good purpose, you wouldn't play that card unless you really had to. But you had pressure upon you with time limits, just like you would for an auditor, just like you would for any kind of budget process, and you had to get things done, and you had to raise that as a boiling point.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You do what you think is the right thing to do in implementation of controls and also in corrective action. And yes, sometimes we probably overplayed the card of
we all have a trump card in our pocket somewhere, right?
That's right. It's got to be done for SOX purposes, and that's not too different from one of the things. And I find this interesting that we're seeing these days is in a number of companies where the audit committee has said, and or at least has allowed the chief audit executive to say that if corrective action is not implemented by the time it's supposed to be implemented by management, then it won't be the chief audit executive who is reporting it to the audit committee. It'll be the person responsible for the implementation of the corrective action who's going to be called to present to the audit committee why
i.e. get on track and get it done.
Exactly.
If you commit to a date, make it happen.
That's right. Otherwise, you're going to have to explain to the board why it didn't.
Personally. I love that. Well, the world is so uncertain these days. We're still coming out of an economic slump, and there's a debate as to whether in the U.S. we're in a double dip, whether we ever got out of the first recession or what. There are a lot of different perspectives on that. The role of the chief audit executive must be one of the most difficult roles to play in any organization. And I know that you've said that in preparation for the program. Explain a little bit about the chief audit executive role as you see it, and how do you feel about that role?
I think the chief audit executive's role is so important because they have the opportunity to do so much for the organization, and not just for the organization, but for the board and shareholders alike. The internal audit function is a lot of times is directed to do things that they certainly have the skills to do, but they may not be directed to do those things that they also have additional skills or capacity to do that would bring additional value to the organization.
Like what? Give us an example.
Well, typically, chief audit executives, heads of audit departments, and their staff typically know a great deal about corporate governance. And a lot of times you don't have the audit organization having any role in the implementation or responsibility for corporate governance, whether it's training people on corporate governance, whether it's ensuring compliance with corporate governance rules. We tend to be financially focused and focused on those controls that either are in operations as well, certainly from an IT perspective. But typically it's those controls that hit the bottom line, and certainly nothing wrong with that. And I would never suggest that we deviate from that. All I'm suggesting is that we could enhance that. It'd be great that there are many internal audit organizations, and especially those chief audit executives, who have additional skills that could be utilized. You know, one of the great things about the internal audit organization is it's hard for me, and I've been in other organizations, worn several hats in my career. Maybe that's just a sign of how old I am, but it gives you an opportunity to say, well, from the perspective of running an IT group or an HR group or an internal audit group, where does one get the best perspective of the entire company and really understand what makes a company work? What's the culture of the company? How do the different departments work together? It's not that can't be gathered or obtained from another department, but internal audit, if you keep your eyes open and your ears open, you can't help but learn those things because you're in all the departments. You're talking with the executives and people at all levels in those departments. You're looking into the guts of the corporation, and so you have that opportunity. It's there for you to take if you just keep your eyes open and listen. And it's a great and I just don't know that there's another organization in any company that gives a person that kind of opportunity.
And when I was in internal audit, the company that I was with used the function as a management trainee ground, if you will. And I'm saying that somewhat loosely, but it was an opportunity for you to be in the organization. And we used to joke at the time that you had to serve your time. The audit director would not let us leave before 3 years. And I fortunately got out after two. I guess there was an opportunity and I jumped at it. But that gave you an opportunity to be at various different levels of the company, to be with people that are very much at the ground level, grassroots, doing the work, facing customers, all the way through to a manufacturing environment where essentially you're managing the assets of the company and creating the future revenue flow. And it was very much an operational role for me, albeit that I had my finance hat. So it gave me a lot of awareness that I wouldn't ever had. And it also gave me opportunity and exposure to executive that I would never have had.
Exactly. And ironically, I did the same thing. My first exposure to internal auditing was on a rotational program. It was a four-year program. At the end of the 4 years, I was enjoying what I was doing. I had the opportunity to do some groundbreaking, at least at the time, groundbreaking internal audit activities, and asked if I could stay for a second tour. And they graciously allowed me to. And for those years, I had a wonderful time and learned a lot. And is it all great? No. I mean, there's just like there are parts of it that are the tough part of the job.
There's a lot of routine as well.
There is routine, but what I saw then and what I'm seeing more of now is that there's a lot of room for innovation.
Yeah.
And
you know, it's interesting. About 12, 15 years ago, many internal audit functions actually started renaming themselves as a consulting division. And there was that very creative, kind of Google-esque focus. And we seem to have reverted back to a conservatism with a small c.
I think that's right.
Compliance.
That's right. And I think what you're seeing is that boards don't always feel comfortable with the concept of and their internal audit group doing consulting. They when they do see the value, they see it maybe at the expense of the traditional audit work getting done. And at the end of the day, if I'm the chair of the audit committee, I want to ensure that the audit plan, which is ensuring that the risk that have been identified through my ERM, my enterprise risk management, and other sources, that those risks are being properly mitigated and that those internal controls that the company has spent a lot of money on to put in place, that those controls are designed effectively and that they're being complied with. Now, I think what you do see and what I'm seeing is that there are a lot of companies that have the pendulum has, as you pointed out, the consulting pendulum has swung back from almost 180 degrees, and now it's settling somewhere closer to less consulting, but there's still some consulting, and you see a lot of it around IT projects. You see a lot of it around implementation of even HR, some new HR systems, but. And from the internal audit perspective, too, you got to be careful to avoid a conflict of interest, because you don't want to be the guy or gal who goes in on a consulting, an internal audit consulting engagement and says, here's some recommendations on how to do it. And then 6 months later, you're in there auditing it, and you say, well, that wasn't designed very well. And, well, let's see, yeah. Who made those recommendations?
Oh, we did.
Yeah, exactly.
So oops.
Yeah. So, and that's where the conflict of interest comes in. So there's a balance, and it really is a very fine line you've got to be careful of. And I think the audit committees see that and makes them a little bit nervous as well.
A little bit nervous, yeah. And you never want your audit committee to be nervous.
No.
Things happen when that occurs.
That is the very last thing you want.
Well, you've been an audit, compliance, and governance executive for over 20 years, and you've reported to a number of executives and boards over that time. Can you tell us about a particular effective executive or board member that you've worked with that perhaps brings true some particular traits or personal characteristics? What was there about his or her management style and skill set that made them stand out in your mind?
Well, I've been, extremely fortunate and have been able to work with just some brilliant people, and just a few of them that come to mind. And I hate to name names because you always leave someone out, but Clark Bailey and Horace Sibley and Cliff Bickle, guys who are on the board at Glen Eyre and EDCI Holdings. And those guys taught me so much, and I would say all of them were mentors to me, and I've probably had tons of mentors, and maybe I'm a slow learner and I need more than most, but you know, each of them taught me something very valuable and very different from the others. Horace taught me that ethics is everything, and when the question comes up, should you do something or not do something, and did a person do something, what was the right thing to do? And with Horace, it was always about ethics, and it was always about what's the right thing to do. And it didn't matter whether it would cost the company a little bit more or a little bit less delay an implementation of something. It was what's the right thing to do. Cliff Bickle, who is the chair of the audit committee, who I had the great pleasure to work very closely with, and Cliff was who was a CFO prior to being on the serving on the board as a chair, very nuts and bolts from a financial standpoint, and understood income statements and balance sheets better than anyone I've ever seen. And you a lot of times you don't see that on the boards. He is the kind of guy you'd love to have on your board because he understood the importance of it. And it's not to pick it apart, but because he really understood the impact that anything might have. So you'd very efficient. And then Clark Bailey, CEO and chairman, and Clark, who was commuting from New York to Atlanta for several years, believe it or not, and until we moved the corporate headquarters, we sold the division in Atlanta and moved the headquarters. But Clark was probably better than anyone I've ever met at keeping things in perspective, and kind of the sun's always going to come up tomorrow. And if today things aren't working out, tomorrow it's
going to be better.
Don't worry. Yeah. I mean, not don't worry about it, but keep it in perspective. It's not the end of the world. And great management talent, great interpersonal skills, and great communicator.
Sounds like a good complement as a threesome.
Oh, these guys were just some of the best. I mean, I would work for them. I'd probably pay them to work for any company they were involved
in. Don't say that over air. You're on public record. They won't pay you your last paycheck.
Well, they're terrific guys, and they're off doing other stuff these days.
Understand. No, I understand. Well, let's talk a little bit about mentoring. You've mentioned it once or twice. You are involved in the Georgia Tech Mentoring Program. What is it, and how did you get involved?
Georgia Tech has, through their ATDC organization, this wonderful facility that allows people like myself who have business experience or entrepreneurial experience to come in and help young people, actually, I guess there's no qualification of age, but people who want to start their own business. And most of the people who come through the program are Georgia Tech grad students or recently graduated or people in the surrounding technology communities who have a great idea. They have great engineering skills, great science skills, but they may not have the financial acumen to understand what's involved in starting a business. They have a concept. They want to
put legs on it and make it run.
That's right. That's exactly right. And but they don't know how to do it. So this program through Georgia Tech, which is teaches people from kind of the soup to nuts on what you need to do to get funding, to what are the legal issues, what kind of incorporation papers you need, the side benefit is that that's folks like me from the outside come in and help people participate and help these people, give them ideas. They can bounce ideas off of us.
It's a full-blown incubator. It really does help with the legal background, the accounting background, the business background. and the ability to what I would call memorialize, use patents, trademarks, and all the intellectual property assets protection that exists. I must say that I've been a little bit involved in Georgia Tech, and I think they're one of the supreme universities in the U.S. that actually helps. And we've become quite a creator of companies that have come out of the incubator.
Absolutely. And Georgia Tech, of course, is world-renowned for a lot of things. But and this is another one that I think that over the years, as this builds up steam, and it's already a well-established program, but
I think they have over 300 companies right now that are in the incubation phase.
That's right, and they've several, obviously, so a lot of companies have, as they call it, graduated, and they've gotten their funding, and they've gone on to success, and so it's a tremendous opportunity. And one of my favorite things. Parts of it is just meeting these mostly young people, hearing their ideas, and their ideas are just phenomenal. I mean, if you don't think that there is some great ideas coming out of the Southeast United States, these young men and women have some of the greatest ideas imaginable. And they're not necessarily all super high tech. There are some things that are kind of low tech or no tech. They're just innovative in whatever the area happens to be. And every year they have a business plan competition, which it sounds like you may have heard of or been a part of. It's the most fun thing. They should open it. They should put it in the stadium and open it up, sell tickets, because I'm telling you, people would come. It's the most fun thing to hear these ideas and read these business plans that these kids have developed.
What I love about it is the awkwardness of seeing these graduate students in a suit for the first time. Very often they've borrowed it and it doesn't fit.
or the business plans themselves, which have maybe written typed out on double sided or on both sides of the paper with handwritten notes.
Yeah,
and so these guys, they're great engineers, great scientists, but they haven't quite learned how to present a formal document.
But through this process, they learn.
Exactly, and that's the point
of it.
That's
fabulous. Well, let's talk, before we conclude, you're also on the board of the Saving American Jobs Foundation. I don't know anything about this organization, but it sounds like we need it.
Well, now more than ever, I would say, I'd make the argument that there's never been a time we didn't need it, but certainly today this is a great organization. And it's a new organization founded by Jim Childs. Jim is a former banker. He has years, probably as many years in the banking world as I do in the internal audit world. And Jim had this vision and that as a foundation, a nonprofit, but organization could save jobs more efficiently than the federal government or state government can do it. And the way this works is large companies, the AT&T's I won't name names, but a big company will make a grant to the foundation, to our foundation. We will then take those dollars and use them to help a small company that may be having some cash flow problems, may be having some receivables problems, some late payment problems due to cyclical issues, some creditors are slow paying them, in which puts them in the situation of maybe potentially having to lay off some people. We can then come in and use those grant dollars to make loans to these companies, short-term loans typically, but not necessarily, it could be longer term, and thereby saving those jobs. And then when they do get out of their cyclical issues, then they would have the ability to pay back the loans. And we can do it at a much more efficiently, certainly than the federal government or state government could come in, because they're not equipped to work on that kind of B2B level.
I understand. And interesting that it's started by a banker. Sounds very much like a private bank almost.
In a sense,
it's a loan source.
It's a loan source, but the original source is money
it's
that's
grants.
Been that or grants.
Is
that's
it a
right.
nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit, and that's the intent of it, that it would be that way. It's not meant to be we're not meant to be a credit union or a company or a small bank or something like that.
It's sure. Wonderful. Well, what a great organization. Well, Richard, unfortunately, we're nearing the end of the show, and we have a tradition on the show to ask all of our guests their CFO tip of the month. Yours may be a little bit different from the perspective of the executive, but what is yours?
Well, my tip to anyone, especially a younger person, you know, making their way in the business world, would be to keep in mind the skill and will, or and another way of saying it is attitude. Attitude is so important in everything you do in life, but especially as you're a young person making your way in the business world. As you mature and through your business life, the people who are your peers are going to have skills that most likely are going to have the skills you have. What separates people as they go through life is attitude, and attitude is what makes other people want to be around you and makes you want to do things and be successful. And it's not to say we all walk around with a smile on our face every day. But attitude is that mentality that says, you know, I'm willing to try something new. I might try the job that somebody else. Maybe it's not the glamour, sexy job of the week, but you know, I'm willing to learn. I want to learn something new, and if it needs to be done, it's, you know, if someone needs to wear, if there's a hat that needs to be worn, and the company needs it, or a particular executive needs a job done, I'm willing to do it, and that's what I mean by attitude. And I think that is the best tip I could give anyone.
Well, that's a fabulous tip. Thank you very much. And let me formally say thank you to Richard Friedman, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on assessing internal audit departments as it impacts the chief audit executive and also the CFO. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lorraine. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks also to our contributor, BDN. The survey that is detailed earlier may be found on their website at www.boarddirectorsnetwork.org. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. And thanks to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.